Welcome to In Context War Report. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe. With me is In Context military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott-Rowe. In the struggle for global military hegemony, the United States faces formidable challenges from two countries. In the West, Russia has emerged from the wreckage of the Soviet Union with greater military strength than ever. And in the East, the United States faces a powerful rival in China, a newcomer to the international stage. In today's program, we're going to focus on China. By examining turning points in the military and political history of China, we'll try to understand the Chinese approach to war and evaluate the military capabilities of today's China relative to the United States. While China is new to the global scene, in fact, its reputation in military affairs goes back a long way. In the 6th century BC, even before China was unified, the Chinese produced a military leader and thinker whose treatise on warfare is studied by generals around the world to this day. Marshawn, please tell us about the Chinese general Sun Tzu and his famous book, The Art of War.
Well, Sun Tzu's Art of War is, as far as we know, the oldest treatise written on war. It was originally written on sticks of bamboo that were bound together. That's how Chinese books were written up until very recently, under, you know, the various monarchs. But Sun Tzu was more than just a general. He took warfare and military science to a science. He made it a science. And he wrote this Art of War basically as a guide to how to win battles.
Actually, he was a successful general himself.
Well, that's what I'm saying, is he wasn't just a military philosopher, if you will. He actually implemented these. And his most notable war was between the state of Wu and the state of Chu. The state of Wu, I believe it was gravely outnumbered by the state of Chu. And Sun Tzu was brought in to help defend the state of Wu. So with an army a quarter the size of the state of Chu, Sun Tzu was able to actually not only defeat his enemy, but destroy their military capabilities completely. And it was using the tactics he spoke about in his book.
And the tactics, as he talks about them, are really philosophical. It's almost a spiritual approach to warfare. And that's, I think, why it's studied today. Sun Tzu is studied today by a businessman who see in his insights into warfare, strategies, tactics that they can use in business. And one of his, I think, key principles, maybe his most important principle, is that subjugating the enemy army without fighting is the pinnacle of excellence.
And this doesn't mean that Sun Tzu was afraid of battle. I want to stipulate that right off the bat. What he believed is that you guaranteed victory before going onto the battlefield. You never engaged in a battle where you didn't know you were going to win, you know, where there was any question whether you were going to win or not. If you implemented all of Sun Tzu's principles holistically, you were guaranteed to win. What he's trying to get across is a philosophical principle that we really don't see in the West. You see, there are two different kinds of games. One's chess, which was popular in the Middle Ages and popular in the West. And I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with chess. The principle is it's a game of attrition. You wear down your enemy, wear down your enemy, wear down your enemy, and eventually topple his king. Well, Sun Tzu followed what's called a Go strategy. Go is a Chinese game and is very popular in Japan as well, in Korea. And the principle of the game was to conquer as much territory as possible using as few pieces as possible. And it's using subterfuge, it's using subtle strategy. And you see this tactic implemented as most notably, my favorite example personally is the Vietnam War, how instead of confronting the Americans' marched armies out into the open, tanks and planes and whatnot, in order to smash North Vietnamese Army units, so the North Vietnamese Army instead went underground and ambushed us and did hit-and-run attacks, and not even small hit-and-run attacks. I mean, you're talking large-scale ambushes and whatnot, but this was the Go strategy juxtaposed to the chessboard
and
strategy.
In fact, General Giap, who was the successful commander of the North Vietnamese army, was an avid student of Sun Tzu.
Absolutely. In fact, he implemented Sun Tzu's strategies in fighting the French. Also, I would like to note that General Giap is actually still alive too. I looked him up quite recently, and he's still alive. He's 104, I believe.
So everything a lot depends on strategic positioning rather than just hammering the guy with the frontal assault.
Absolutely.
And one of the insights that I gather from his writings is that you want to force the enemy to move. You want to be in control of where your enemy goes, and that could be done by attacking an objective that he has to defend, or could be simply by tempting him with some area of supposed weakness, so you get him to move where you want him to go.
And there's actually a phenomenal example of this when during the war between the state of Wu and the state of Chu, when the state of Chu had their army outside the capital city of the state of Wu. And so the question was, well, how was Sun Tzu didn't have an army big enough to break the siege. So what he did is he took his small army out around behind the army of the state of Chu, invaded Chu territory and started attacking their cities. So now the Chu army was forced to break the siege of the Wu capital and chase after Sun Tzu. One of my favorite quotes is, "Do not let the enemy control the timing of the battle. If an opportunity arises, move quickly." And Sun Tzu, that to me summarizes that, along with attack where they are, what is weak, and avoid what is strong. It's the same principle. You choose the timing and the place of the battle. And that really was one of Sun Tzu's main principles. You never fight on the enemy's terms. So trying to break the siege would have been fighting on the enemy's terms. But trying to draw the enemy out, trying to tempt the enemy out, is fighting on your terms. Now you choose the battlefield. Kind of like what the Confederates could have done at Gettysburg. When they were having invaded the North, what they could have done, what Lee should have done, is once he encountered the Union army at Gettysburg, was now retreat to higher ground and force the Union to chase him, because they would have.
And this goes to another important principle of Sun Tzu, which is that one who excels at warfare first establishes himself in a position where he cannot be defeated. That is a strong defensive position. You've got to be assured of that. Once you've got that, then you can go out and attack. You're in control.
Well, yeah. I mean, Sun Tzu was a master of defense as well as offense, but he also said the best defense is a good offense.
Well, that way you control the movement. You determine where your opponent is going to go.
And you also catch your opponent flat-footed.
I love the image that Sun Tzu uses, where he compares the army's disposition of forces to water. He said, avoid it being a substantial. Avoid it being like rigid. It's got to flow. And that to me is like such a different concept, where we're used to thinking of dug-in positions and entrenchments.
That is very much the Eastern philosophy when it comes to warfare, and indeed when it comes to martial arts. I took Taekwondo many years ago, and one of the very, very strong principles I learned from it was Grandmaster Kang used to say, he said, water doesn't go through a rock. He said, if there's a rock in the stream, water doesn't go through it, water goes around it. And everything flows. And on the battlefield, if you can keep yourself fluid, not just as an individual, but as a commander, you can constantly adapt to the changing battlefield. One of the problems the U.S. military has, especially today, but it's a problem that's plagued Western militaries throughout our history, is total inflexibility. If you get attacked, commanders aren't taught to use their initiative. You get attacked, now you have to call up to higher, and then they have to call their superior, and they have to call their superior, and they have to call their superior just to get instructions as to what the guy on the bottom is supposed to do. Whereas if you're very fluid, the guy on the bottom should be able to make a command decision on the battlefield and say, okay, we've encountered this obstacle. This is how we're going to go around it. This is how we're going to react. And the commander at the top can also be fluid and say, okay, well, we've encountered this obstacle. I'm getting reports. My commanders are doing this. I'm going to start doing this. When you have a very rigid plan, the moment anything goes wrong, you can no longer adapt. And that's a problem we see with modern, particularly American military strategy.
Well, now, as we mentioned, his study, The Art of War, his treatise, has been evaluated and studied right down through the centuries up to this time. And as we'll talk about later, one of his greatest students was Mao Zedong, the leader of the establishment of who established the communist state, the Communist Republic in China, who was a very successful military leader as well. But one of the people who followed him very soon after, well, one of the early followers of Sun Tzu, was the first emperor and his advisor, the first emperor of China, who lived about who lived in the 3rd century BC, about 200 or 300 years after Sun Tzu. Can you tell us about Ying Shang and his advisor Li Su?
One of the things I would like to say is, when we say China's a new player to the world stage, China became a state while Rome was still in its infancy. So, and Ying Jin was the perfect example of that. This was during the period of what is known as the Warring States in China. So China was broken up into, I believe, 7 kingdoms.
Yes.
And they were all vying for control. Now, China had been nominally unified at one stage under a confederation, but then, you know, that would gradually fall apart. You would have one guy who would say, I got everything, unify the kingdoms, and they would crumble. These had greatly weakened all of the neighboring states, except the state of Qin, which managed to somehow keep itself above the fray. It was in the west of the kingdoms. And so Ying Jin, at a young age, is made king. I believe he was 18 years old. Might have been a little younger, might have been 16. His father, the king, who had only been emperor for a short period of time, dies, and I have quotes in there, dies mysteriously. And his mother says, oh, you know, you're emperor now. Make her lover, Lu Bue, the prime minister. So she and the prime minister, Lu Bue, who coincidentally may actually have been Yin Jin's father, thought that they were going to rule. Lu Bue and the mother of Yin Jin thought they would rule. Well, as Yin Jin starts to come of age, he gets an advisor, Li Su. Now, Li Su was brought in as a bureaucrat, and Lu Bue liked him because he was a smart guy. He was a young guy. He was a smart guy, you know, and he was an efficient bureaucrat. So Lu Bue said, yeah, I'll bring you on. But Lu Bue didn't understand what he was doing. He brought in a man who is twice as smart as Lu Bue was and able to influence Yin Jin. Because he said to Yin Jin, he said, look, you are going to be the emperor. You are going to be the emperor of a united China, but this is how you got to do it. And so he established the modern bureaucratic Chinese system. But what's interesting is when we in the West think of bureaucracy, we think of an inefficient, clunky, cumbersome, huge organization. This man was able to establish, Li Su was able to establish a bureaucracy that governed enormous landmass and governed a population larger than the Roman Empire.
So Li Su saw in this young king of what was just one of seven feudal states, he saw the potential, he saw the opportunity to seize greater power.
Exactly. And in fact, he said he wasn't interested in becoming emperor himself. He wanted to enable Yin Jin to unite China. And whether in a Machiavellian sense that he wanted to, whether in a patriotic sense, we'll probably never know. But what's interesting is that he said to the young Yin Jin, an opportunity comes once every 10,000 years, yet rarely does history place in its path a man capable of acting upon it. And that's very much indicative of the Chinese philosophy. The Chinese, and if we look at, you know, the modern era, you'll see the Chinese will be patient and they'll wait and wait and they'll study their enemy. Like Sun Tzu said, know your enemy is to know yourself, and in 100 battles you will always be victorious. That is what the Chinese have spent really since the beginning of the Cold War doing, is studying us. And so they're just waiting for that opportunity that comes once every 10,000 years to destroy us. And that's when Yin Jin went to war with the other warring states. When he became a man and started waging war was because he saw the opportunity that comes once every 10,000 years.
What were his strengths as a warrior, do you think?
He was a battlefield commander. He was on the front lines himself. He was not afraid to get his sword bloody or his boots dirty. He commanded from the front, and he commanded a tremendous amount of respect amongst his men and his people. Another thing he did, which I think surprised a lot of people, is he allowed for social upward mobility. You were promoted and paid extra for every head you brought back. So if you could start out as a peasant warrior and end your military career as a nobleman if you killed enough enemy soldiers. So people felt that with this man, there was not only a chance for victory and unity, but a chance now to move socially higher. So he allowed for social upward mobility.
And he didn't mess around. Can you talk about the incident where he had 10,000 Zhao prisoners?
Oh, yes. This was when he defeated the state of Zhao. That was really his first adversary, his first real adversary in his reconquest of China. And he...
Well, the tradition then was you were merciful towards your prisoners.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely. China is a land of oxymorons in many ways, or contradiction, I should say, not oxymorons, contradictions in many ways, because it's, on the one hand, they had this very strong Confucian philosophy that said, you know, you treat prisoners well, you treat them with respect. And then on the other hand, they had a sense of total war that doesn't exist as much in the rest of the world. The Chinese have a principle of absolute war. When you wage war, it's not just to defeat your enemy, it's to totally and utterly subjugate your enemy. And when he fought the state of Zhao, he had 10,000 prisoners. And so he says, do you know what to do with them? And he has them all executed. And he says, there's only one way for the Qin to survive, and that is to conquer.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marchand McDermott Rowe about China as a rival to the United States for global power.
And now you look forward into the Chinese mindset. There's only one way for the Qin to survive, and that is to conquer. So when backed into a position where it's starvation and death or conquest and survival, they will conquer.
So China is born in military conquest.
Absolutely. And a conquest, a need of conquest out of survival. Out of a need of survival.
So at the age of about 34, he conquers all of these competing feudal states. He forms a unified, he conquers them, but it's really Li Su Lu Su's genius that forges them into a nation. He takes some very strong steps. And one of them is that he abolishes feudalism. First of all, Ying Chang changes his name, right? That's the first
thing. Exactly. Artist. Well, the first thing he does, and this is part of, I think, under the tutelage of Lu Su, Ying Jin changes his name to Qin Shi Huangdi, which means the first divine emperor of the Qin. The first divine emperor of China. And he wore a crown of beads that fell in front of his face, so that this way it was as if he was looking from heaven, which follows in line with the Confucian order. You see, they capitalize upon the Confucian order of the emperor being the son of heaven, being divine, interpreting the will of heaven, and those below are bound in obedience to those above, as those above are bound in obedience to those to the will of heaven, and the emperor being divine, being the only one who can interpret the will of heaven. And you see that in China with almost the deification of Mao.
Yes, it's almost like they still, even though the emperor exists no more, they need an emperor somehow.
Well, you can't just erase somebody's culture. Just because you coat them in hammer and sickles and red flags doesn't mean they've given up who they are.
But he and Lu Su decided that they wouldn't appoint his nephews or cousins or whatever, what have you, as nobles to run these feudal states. They came up with an interesting idea, which was to appoint governors as heads of each of the states who would report directly to the emperor. Well, so you get rid of the potential for feudal breakup of the country.
That's also why when they say that China was the first state, it legitimately was the first state, you know, because people tend to say, well, states didn't really exist until post-Renaissance. But no, I mean, this really was the first modern state. What we would understand in the modern world as a modern state, they got rid of feudalism. They had governors. The governors acted only upon the laws decreed by the emperor. The emperor at one stage decided that all books should be burned. And so all books were burned. And the magistrates made sure it happened. The other thing, though, the magistrates did was make sure that there was one copy made of every book to be put in the imperial library.
It was so very interesting. They burned all the history books. It's almost like 1984. Gives you some insight, I think, into the Chinese mind, because they wanted to make sure, the emperor wanted to make sure that the version of history that survived was his version of history. But when it came to science, technology, agriculture, he kept one copy of each book, and he put it in his own library, so he did have a monopoly of knowledge.
And even when it comes to history, he wants to know the truth. He doesn't want the plebs to know the truth, but he still does, you know, because then this way he can better understand.
They also create this huge bureaucracy, which really is part now becomes a very important part of their culture.
Absolutely. But it's an efficient bureaucracy. And I think that's one of the things that shocks people when they look at China is how the Chinese, especially nowadays, can move as a unit. You know, we in the United States, when something comes down from Washington and they say, we're going to do X, well, it gets caught up in committee for, you know, decades. But in China, when the premier says, we're doing X, the whole nation moves as a unit. Every bureaucrat on the way down pushes that letter forward, pushes that order forward down to the school teacher and the farmer in the field. Back to this period, 200 BC, the Chinese are really cemented a bureaucratic system that has lasted unto this day.
And the Manchus
just perfected that.
And it's almost a totalitarian system. Lu Su publishes these laws that they don't just determine how the government's going to function. It controls your private affairs too. So they behead you if you committed adultery.
Well, that's not much different from the West. But the difference was that in the West, it was religion that governed. Because in the West, in Christendom, in Judaism, well, because this was before Christendom, but in Judaism, a woman could have been stoned to death for adultery. But this is the fundamental difference. For the Jews, those laws came from God. Later on, after the BCs, for the Christians, those laws came from God. But for the Chinese, the laws came from a man believed to be divine. That is a very important insight. Because laws in the West governing morality, whether it's Judaism, Christianity, Islam, or even Hinduism, come from a divine being up above. Whereas in this case, the laws that are considered divine come from a man. It's a very unique philosophy. It means that when the leader, the son of heaven, decrees something, it's like a commandment from God. And that's the level that I'm putting this at in terms of their regulating morality. It means that the emperor's decree is a decree from God himself. It puts the emperor on the level of God, which is something you didn't have and don't have in the West.
Well, now, while dynasties came and they left, the imperial system with the God emperor did endure for over 2,000 years. And the Chinese, they saw themselves as the center of the world. So they really didn't have much interest in foreigners. And they remained a pretty isolated, uninvolved in world affairs for many centuries. So in order to understand their relationship with the West today, we need to move forward to fairly recent history, when China first came to grips with the West. And this brings us to a terrible and a very significant chapter in Chinese history, the Opium Wars, which took place. There were two of them, important ones, 1839 to 1842, 1856 to 1860. These were the Opium Wars. Now, Marshawn, could you please talk about the Opium Wars and their influence on Chinese attitudes towards the West today?
Well, the two Opium Wars were really one war with a break in between, with an intermission in between, if you will, in this great Chinese opera, this opera of Chinese history, if you will. What happened is the first Opium War really was started because the Chinese said, we will only trade you our goods for silver. That's it. That's the only form of currency we will accept. That's why there was a sudden drive by the Spanish especially to colonize South America and get the silver out of places like Peru, because they wanted to be able to trade with China. Well, after the Napoleonic Wars, silver, especially Spanish silver, because Spain was the big holder of silver at this point. Britain didn't have any South American colonies. Spain was the big holder of silver. Spain was wrecked by the Napoleonic Wars. They weren't giving out silver. So the Brits say, well, what will you accept in exchange
for... The Brits were running a huge trade deficits with China because the Brits were addicted to tea. They were importing tremendous amounts of tea, ran up huge deficits, and the Chinese wouldn't buy anything the Brits made.
Well, that's what I'm trying to say, is because the Chinese felt themselves, they called themselves the Central Kingdom. They felt that they were the center of the universe. As a result, they wouldn't accept anything other than Spanish silver. For some reason, they would accept silver, but they wouldn't accept... The Brits said, we can give you trains, we can give you advanced firearms, we can give you cannons, we can give you carts.
They didn't see any point in it. Who needs it?
They're like, we're the Central Kingdom. And there was this rather comical incident that occurred when the British ambassador to China came in and said, look, we'll give you anything for your goods. And they said, okay, well, you're going to have to meet the emperor. And it's okay. I say, no, but when you meet the emperor, you're going to have to bow, genuflect, and then place your head on the ground 8 or 9 times. It's called
kowtowing.
Yeah, yes. Which is why you hear that expression sometimes, you know, they're kowtowing to so-and-so. That's what kowtowing is. And the ambassador says, fine, I'll do that. I'll even put my head on the ground 9 times, but you have to do the same to the portrait of King George. And the Chinese said, ah, you're nuts. And they kicked him out. And so the British then decided, well, fine, we'll trade them opium, because the Chinese were addicted to opium.
And the opium was grown in the British colony of India. So they had it in their backyard and they brought it into China.
Exactly. And a lot of people blame Britain for this, but I do think it was to a great extent self-inflicted, because when you actually accept opium as a form of trade, you're kind of doing it to yourself.
However,
at that point,
the Chinese opium was trading was illegal in China, and the top officials in China resisted the importation. In fact, they did something that was kind of like the Boston Tea Party, where they went on board of all these merchant ships that the British and the Americans had. And they were British and Americans, by the way, are making big money from this business. The richest man in America, a man named Stephen Girard of Philadelphia, was a big time opium dealer. The biggest contributor to Princeton University in the 19th century was an opium dealer named John C. Green.
Oh, absolutely.
So there was big money in this. So when the Chinese officials came on board the British and the American ships and threw all the opium in the water, this literally meant war.
Well, it did, but also one important thing to remember was that while some of the officials did this, trying to enforce the opium ban was kind of like trying to enforce prohibition. Everybody was against it, but meanwhile, the mayor and governor were still having a glass of whiskey. 60 to 70% of the emperor's court were full-blown opium addicts. They say roughly 60% of the Chinese population were full-blown opium addicts. So trying to enforce the ban was hard because your officials were getting stoned as well.
Yeah, the army, the generals, everybody.
You had some very honest officials that tried to stop it. But again, like I say, it's like trying to enforce prohibition.
Well, when the government did, what was the response of the British when the Chinese leaders threw the opium into the water?
Well, that incident in particular happened when the Chinese emperor finally decided he had enough. And even though 60% of his court were full-blown addicts, they said, we've had enough. We're going to stop this. Well, the Brits, who are running a deficit, and indeed the Americans were as much to endorse this as well, because, you know, people were now losing money. So Britain invades China with the backing of the United States and other European powers, but particularly the United States. And China gets decimated. And it is kind of comical. It'd be farcical if it wasn't tragic. There were battles where literally not a single British soldier died because the Chinese were so stoned out of their minds on opium, they didn't fight.
And their weapons, it was one side in terms of the weaponry, was it?
Well, that too, as well.
They had these old junks, old-fashioned sailboats up against steam-powered warships. Well, that's the British had.
That's true too. But I mean, the Chinese army too couldn't function. I mean, it wasn't like even in the Boxer Rebellion, which we'll get into in a little bit. Even then, fighting with swords, they still stood a chance. Yeah, these guys were
zonked out.
Their leaders were zonked. It's like a Cheech and Chong routine.
These poor guys have got swords. They've got these brown best muskets up against a modern weaponry and cannons.
And they're stoned.
And they're completely stoned. They didn't have a chance, and they lost. And then there was a truce. And as you say, it was really an intermission because the war was renewed a few years later.
Exactly. And this greatly impacted the Chinese because it was incredibly humiliating. It also shattered their sense of isolation. They felt that all other men were barbarians. They were the civilized. They were the central kingdom. All other men were barbarians. So this shattered their worldview.
At the end of the second installment of the war, the emperor's palace was burned to the ground. And this was not just a house. This had tremendous artistic significance for Chinese culture.
It would be comparable to the loss of the Library of Alexandria.
And in addition to that, when the peace treaty, which the emperor had to submit, be humiliated, the Chinese were forced to effectively legalize opium.
And additionally, one of the things that's kind of covered up is this is when we begin to see concessions appear in China. Concessions are Western cantonments, which mean they're little bits of land that are owned by a foreign country where foreign law rules. And it was after the Second Opium War that you began to see the emergence of British concessions. You saw Russian concessions, German concessions, French concessions. After the Meiji Restoration in Japan in the 1870s, you began to see Japanese concessions, and most notably, you began to see American concessions. Now, this is an aspect of American history that's very effectively covered up. If you watch the movie 55 Days in Peking, great movie, but one of the things they say is the American ambassador says, America has no interest in China. We have no concessions. Never had any, don't want any. Well, no, America did have concessions in China.
That was disingenuous.
America had concessions in China, but it wasn't until after the Boxer Rebellion that we had lots of troops in China.
And it was a great affront, of course, to their sovereignty. I mean, could you imagine in New York having large parts of the most desirable parts of New York City divided and controlled by foreign countries where American law would no longer ruled, where the foreign law ruled. And this is happening also at a time where the country was falling apart due to internal rebellions, no doubt brought upon by the abject humiliation of the central government, the emperor.
Exactly.
And the opium wars. If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marchand McDermott Rowe about China as a rival to the United States for global power. So the Chinese were getting it from every side. This led to an unrest directed towards the foreigners who not only had these great business concessions, but they also had Christian missionaries running throughout the country, which were making converts and causing a tremendous amount of resentment on the part of the Chinese.
However well-intentioned one may be as a missionary, when you go into a foreign country and you try to change their way of life, whether it's by showing up and saying, listen, it's all well and nice that you have tribal leaders, but now you're going to answer to some guy in Kabul, or whether you're showing up saying, well, listen, we know you all pray to Buddha, but now you're all going to pray to Jesus. The problem is that upsets the balance that exists in a society. Now, normally in a stable society, missionaries don't bother anyone. But when you have an unstable society, uncertainty, lawlessness, people will grab onto whatever their culture
and
is.
And the missionaries are seen as just really the front guard, the advanced attacking force of the foreign colonial
people. Exactly. They felt that it was the foreigners trying to destroy the last of their Chineseness.
Well, now you mentioned the movie 55 Days in Peking. That takes place during the Boxer Rebellion, which is this explosion against the foreign interference in China. Can you talk about the Boxers and how that rebellion turned out?
Well, the Boxers were martial artists, and they were also religious fanatics. They adhered to a very unusual religion, but they believed that magic charms and witch doctors could protect them from bullets. And they were very talented martial artists, but they were a clandestine movement that eventually led an uprising on behalf of the Empress Zhe Shi, and the rebellion actually was in 1900.
Yes.
Was when the rebellion became full-blown.
Right.
They would attack missionaries occasionally. And the empress comes out and she says, well, you know, I'm going to stop trying to appease the foreigners. In 1900, the Boxers launched an all-out uprising with a wink and nod from the empress. And then when it appeared they might be successful, the empress committed the imperial troops. And the most seminal event of this war was the foreigners holding out inside the walls of Peking, holding out in their foreign cantonment with troops from a dozen different countries, Japanese, French, Russian, German, Americans, Spanish, Italians. And as they say, it was the first time all Europeans
were
playing
the same tune.
They're
really waiting to be rescued by foreign troops invading China, right?
Exactly. And they were. A foreign army showed up, a combination of many different countries invaded. And this is really when the partitioning of China really became full-blown.
So the Western armies defeat the armies of the empress, and the empress's government was really kind of split, right, between whether to openly defy the foreigners or whether to join the Boxers or whether they should back down.
A lot felt it was just a bad time. The timing was wrong. And what had happened is the foreigners showed up. They devastated the Chinese army. They basically subjugated China. And 11 years later, there was an event which is forever painted into the minds of all Chinese, even today. The date is called Shuangshi, which means double 10. It was October 10th, 1911. There was a rebellion in the Yangtze Valley, which the Chinese government couldn't suppress. And overnight, the Manchu government that lasted for hundreds of years disappeared.
The Manchu, of course, had been over 2,000 years of divine emperors. The Manchus had been in power for almost 300 years. But with the Boxer Rebellion, that was a turning point. They really lost their credibility. The government, the Chinese government, was forced to pay huge indemnities to Western governments. I mean, think of the humiliation. They invade you, you have to pay
them.
Well,
the same thing happened after the Opium Wars as well.
Yes, and at the end of the Boxer Rebellion, the Westerners demanded the execution of Chinese government officials that had supported the rebellion, and the Chinese government had to agree to the stationing of Western troops in the capital. So this is probably why the dynasty was so weakened by these events that when it finally collapsed in 1911, it was actually not that big a surprise. I guess one of the questions I ask, why didn't another dynasty take its place?
Because this had never happened before. A dynasty never just disappeared. And that's why I'm saying made it so shocking was the fact that the dynasty quite literally just disappeared. It ceased to exist. After existing for 300 years, it's just gone. And you had warlords spring up. Well, this isn't like anything that had ever happened in Chinese history before, since the unification.
Right, it's like going back 2,300 years.
Exactly. What had previously happened is one dynasty would emerge, overthrow the other, and you just have a change of dynasties. The thing is you didn't have that. It just disappeared and became feudal states again. They went back to feudalism, which they hadn't had for 2,300 years. What you're seeing is a total collapse in the Chinese way of life. And that's why you didn't see a new emperor, but they were looking for an emperor. So you had Sun Yat-sen, who comes out and he says, you know, he had an idea of a Chinese republic, and he had the three principles. And the three principles were first democracy, then socialism, then communism. And he was a man of ideas. And they say in China at the time period, there were two kinds of people in China, the man of ideas and the men of guns. Warlords were the men of guns. Sun Yat-sen was a man of ideas.
Well, he was the most important civilian leader, as I understand it, until his death from 1911 until the 1925. Also, he was a Christian, so he was a more Western-oriented fellow.
Absolutely. But what makes Sun Yat-sen very interesting is that he had ideas but no army. And that was part of the problem. The warlords had the armies, but no ideas. And everybody was grasping for a way to unify China, even many of the warlords.
Was he thinking in terms of a Western-style government, maybe a social Western-style socialist government?
At first, his eventual goal was communism, and that's what the people's three principles were. And that's why both Chiang Kai-shek, who became the head of the Nationalist Party, who was a student of Sun Yat-sen's, and Mao Zedong also both claim to descend, in essence, ideologically from Sun Yat-sen. Mao just said, I'm moving to the third stage, which is communism. Chiang Kai-shek said, I'm still at the first stage, basically. Sun Yat-sen began to build an army, began to build a republic, began to finally unite the nation, and then dies of throat cancer. So then Chiang Kai-shek, who was his protege, as it were, he was the commander at the Wampo Military Academy, in Nanking, he basically steps in and says, I'm the general, I command the troops, I'm going to now lead the new republic. Well, Mao, later on down the road, gets involved with the communists and says, no, communism is the way to go. And so then China erupts into civil war, and it stays in a period of civil war until 1933. That is when you have a sudden refocus. Communists and nationalists start to get together. The nationalists still fight the communists, but eventually they get together.
It's sort of an intermission in the Civil War.
Exactly.
To fight the Japanese.
And they fight the Japanese. And then the United States, meanwhile, supplied both the nationalists and the communists. But I saw an interesting interview not that long ago with the former American OSS officer who was in China at the time. And he was riding with a Chinese officer. And they stopped to get water for their horses in a village. And the woman in the village says to them, who are you? And a young Chinese officer says, we are from the 8th Route Army. The American says to the Chinese officer, says, what are you talking about, 8th Route Army? We're nationalists. And the officer says, shut up. If we tell them we're nationalists, they'll never give us water. The nationalists had sullied their name in the brutal way in which they waged war against the communists. But both Chiang Kai-shek and Mao were fighting for the role of the new emperor. They both had these divine auras around them. Mao was just doing a better job at it.
Well, Mao was a great political leader, great communist. He establishes this communist regime, but people may not be aware he was also a great military man. Can you talk about his military career?
Oh, absolutely. He was a genocidal dictator who killed 80 million people. But he was a brilliant genocidal dictator who killed 80 million people. People tend to say, you know, oh, he was just a communist, just a tyrant. Let's, you know, not even consider him. He was a brilliant military commander. He had no concept of economy, which is why he had mass starvation when he became a dictator. But before then, he wrote a book on guerrilla warfare. It is literally one of the most brilliant treatises on guerrilla warfare I've ever read. It's what every successful insurgency uses. It takes Sun Tzu's principles and it focuses them directly towards a insurgent army. And, you know, the principle of first thing you have to do is escape from your enemy. You have to establish safe havens to train and recruit. And he believed that ideological training was just as important as military training. Now, Chiang Kai-shek was based much more on the Western model. And Chiang Kai-shek said that military training is more important than ideological training. Well, if you don't indoctrinate somebody, if you don't give them ideological training, they won't know what they're fighting for.
Did Mao have any formal military training himself?
No. I mean, he had served for a period in the Nationalist Army. There was, you know, there's kind of where myth meets reality. You're not really sure. He served for a bit under Sun Yat-sen's government, but that's kind of entering the realm of myth. He was basically from a wealthy peasant family, but he got tried on the battlefield.
Talk about the Long March. What was that?
That was the great escape, as it were, for the Chinese People's Liberation Army trying to escape from the Nationalists. And they marched this unbelievable march from, I believe it was the Yangtze Valley. They marched up into the mountains, through the mountains the whole time. Mao was there. And this is what separated Mao from Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang Kai-shek was in an office. Mao, the whole time, was with his troops. He's in the snow. He gave his rations to one of his soldiers. I saw an interview with one of his former soldiers. It was really very powerful, but he had a very command presence. And he rode a white horse. He was also very aware of the use of propaganda, too. He rode a white horse, you know, the concept of the leader on the white horse, the divine emperor, so on and so forth. And he led his army up into Yan'an, which was really remote part of northwestern China. In Yan'an, he established his safe zone to recruit and train his troops.
So he's successful. He defeats Chiang Kai-shek, and in 1949, he establishes the Chinese Communist Republic,
People's Republic of China. Yes.
Now he continues military conquests. In particular, I'm thinking of the conquest of Tibet. And can you talk about that and what that shows about the Chinese attitude towards warfare?
It shows that the Chinese have always laid claim to. Tibet's always been an independent country. It's gotten conquered by China at various stages in its history, but they're an independent ethnic group. They have their own language. They are not Chinese. However, the Chinese laid claim to it. So what Mao did, which no Chinese leader before him had ever really done, he did what the first emperor of China did when he subjugated the rest of China. Mao sent in his army. They come in, they massacre the Tibetan population. I mean, horrific atrocities. They force children to shoot their parents and things like that. And of course, at this time, you know, the United States is trying to cover up the fact that we sided with the communists during the war. So we are not really talking about it. But the fact was, the Chinese were forcing nuns and monks to, you know, do things together. They were forcing children to shoot their parents, things like that. Just these horrible atrocities. And then they brought down millions of Chinese farmers. They changed the written language. They destroyed all of the Tibetan monuments. They destroyed the Dalai Lama's palace in Lhasa, the Tibetan capital. I mean, they just, it was total ethnic cleansing, but it was unique because it was cultural ethnic cleansing because they didn't want to kill all of the Tibetans. What they wanted to do was change the identity. Why did they shoot the parents? Because they want the children to remember. They want to bury that into the children's mind, and then they make children orphans, and they raise them in the state. So that this way, now they're raised speaking Chinese, they're raised reading and writing Chinese, they're raised to think that they're Chinese. And then later on, nowadays, you have Tibetan cultural festivals, and it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like, a good example would be like how we have St. Patrick's Day here in Ireland, or we have the Von Steuben Day, when all the German Americans get together and drink beer and wear lederhosen. It's nice, it's quaint, it's cultural, but we're Americans still. So that's the thing they had doing, they do, the Tibetans do. Yeah, now we celebrate some of our festivals, it's quaint and it's culturey, but we're Chinese. And so it was a cultural genocide. It was more effective than any other genocide. And here we see the effect, the attitude of the Chinese towards total war. When they wage war, it's never, you know, half-hearted. They never go off half-cocked. It's total and absolute against the civilian population. We also see that their goal is not simply to occupy or subjugate, it's to totally annihilate the indigenous culture and change it. And that's how Yin Jin or Qin Shuan Di later wiped out all the other cultures and united China. And
in fact, he imposed the one language, right? He tried anyway.
Exactly. He did. And it fundamentally, it worked. I mean, that's why it's known as China today, is because of him and because of the total cultural genocide he committed against his enemies.
Now, in a way, this is a horrible thing that he was successful at this. He was more successful as a military man, and that's ironic considering he wasn't a professional military man, than he was in actually running the country. If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marchand McDermott Rowe about China as a rival to the United States for global power.
Mao was, in many ways, became a professional military man. The problem is he didn't have a grasp of economics. So he made a lot of very bad mistakes trying to industrialize, because China fundamentally was at the same place it had been in the 1840s, in the 1940s. So during his industrialization process, the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, all went very, very badly. And they say the greatest famine in human history occurred in China at this period. We don't know how many Chinese died during that period, but we know by the end of Mao's rule, 80 million people had died in China as a result of his rule. 80 million, that's a staggering number. But Mao followed Stalin's principle, which is when you kill one, it is a tragedy. But when you kill 10 million, it's a statistic.
The economic gains that China has enjoyed really has taken place since Mao died in 1976. It seems like China has really boomed economically. We now know that it's surpassed the United States as the most significant trading partner with Europe. It's making huge inroads and great influence in places like Africa. So I ask you, has the Chinese military been developing at the same pace as the Chinese civilian economy?
Absolutely. The Chinese had a big wake-up call in 1991. The great enemy, and we forget this, but the great enemy for China since 1840 was the West, and particularly the Americans after World War II.
Well, of course, they fought the war in Korea, which we didn't talk about, and we really don't have time to go into that in any detail, but they have fought us.
Oh, yeah, they fought us. They sent a million men to Korea to fight against us, which is why we ended up losing. Well, not losing, but fighting to a stalemate was because of a million Chinese soldiers. And the only reason we didn't lose the war was because the Chinese weren't as well equipped as we were. China directed all its energy towards the United States. And then in 1991, they saw the first Gulf War, and we were stupid in that we played our hand. Because the Soviet Union collapsed, we thought, we're the superpower, we'll always be the superpower, let's just show everybody what we got.
George Bush Sr. was president then, and when he succeeded Ronald Reagan, who effectively won the Cold War, and when the Soviet Union collapsed under Mikhail Gorbachev, Bush Sr. saw this golden opportunity to really launch a drive for world hegemony, beginning with the Persian Gulf War of 1991.
Very crucially, he showed our hand. He showed every bomber we had. He showcased every weapon system we had. And fundamentally, our weapon systems have changed very little since 1991. The Chinese saw this and went, oh my God, we got to do something. Because the Chinese had weapons from the 60s. They said, we have to make a leap in military technology. So from 1991 to the present, they've been investing very heavily in military technology. Now, this coincides with Vladimir Putin comes to power in Russia in 1999. What is the first thing Putin does is he begins revamping the Russian military, investing in technology, investing in innovation.
And that period of the 90s, essentially almost like a Western colonial period under Boris Yeltsin, who was really privatizing and wrecking the economy and neglecting the military.
Exactly. It was like the colonial period that had happened in China was happening in Russia. Well, into the 2000s, Putin and the Chinese premier at the time, Hu Jintao. It's a bit of an Abbott and Costello routine because when is the president? Who is the prime minister?
But okay. I don't follow you. That's okay.
Who's the prime minister? When's the prime minister? No. Who's the prime minister? Abbott and Costello. Well, yeah. But the fact is though is that when it happened is Hu Jintao gets together with Putin and they said, we agree that our mutual enemy is the United States. And they go, absolutely. The United States has invaded Afghanistan, invaded Iraq. Clearly, they're seeking to pen us in and push us off the world stage. And Putin said, Russia's making a comeback. Russia needs an ally. China hates the United States. China wants to make a comeback. So they form an alliance. And what you start to see happening is all of a sudden, all of the military technology that appears in Russia suddenly appears in China as well. And China develops a new stealth plane. All of a sudden, Russia develops it as well.
Let's talk about some of those new technologies like the stealth plane. What is the advantage of that?
Oh, gosh, this thing is beautiful. Well, the United States tried to invest in a similar one called the F-35. And to be fair, it's very, very close to the Chinese model. Very, very close. I mean, the only difference is that, you know, the Chinese one can fly through lightning. And apparently, if the American F-35 flies through lightning, it explodes. But minor detail.
But the stealth idea is that, it can't be detected by radar?
It can't be detected by radar, but also this thing is a multi-role aircraft. Fundamentally, much of the United States arsenal is based on single role. You have a fighter, which is designed for air-to-air. You have a bomber, which is designed for bombing things. And then you have close air support, but they're specialized. Whereas the Chinese came up with this J-22, which is designed to be able to do all those roles. It's the world's first fifth generation. American fighters are only at fourth generation. The F-22 is technically fifth generation, and so is the F-35. The F-22 has a problem in that it jams when there's sand in it and apparently cuts off the oxygen and kills the pilot. Happened twice. And then the F-35, it flies too close to lightning, explodes. So effectively, the Chinese are the only ones with a real working fifth generation fighter, a fighter bomber. So this thing is capable of doing all those roles. Then mysteriously, all of a sudden, something that looks identical is developed in Russia right afterwards. And so now both the Russians and the Chinese have this. Then Russia develops this new stealth submarine, which uses basically jet propulsion underwater. Now,
so this sounds like this new submarine warfare is something like out of a Tom Clancy novel?
Oh, absolutely. It's The Hunt for Red October, but in real life. And that's, you know, something that makes it kind of hard, I think, for a lot of people to grasp, but it's real.
So the it can't be detected. The advantage of the submarine is it can't be detected when it's moving?
Not by sonar. And the problem is radar underwater radar, which is basically what sonar is, doesn't work very well when you're really close to the bottom. So now you can't hear it. You can't see it. And it's capable of firing ballistic missiles on the move. The Russians have already put three of these to sea, and that's three that we know of. Guaranteed, the Chinese have the same ones too, because the Chinese have been investing incredibly in submarines. That's why them aircraft carriers are really anachronistic. It's good for regional air support, but that's about it.
I never recall, I think it was a year or two ago, a missile was launched off the coast of California. Pictures of it were shown on video, of it was shown on the television, and it looked like a missile. And some reports said that it was launched from a Chinese submarine. Well, the Pentagon immediately denied it and said it was a chemtrail or something.
Well, of course they denied. I saw the video footage myself. It was not a chemtrail. And no one is that stupid to look up to the sky and go, is that a missile or a chemtrail? It's a missile. And
then it looked like a missile.
It looked like a missile to me. I don't know. I'm only a military affairs guy, but
reported as a missile, but it sounded like the Chinese had come right up to our shore just to let us know they could do it. Are they cruising the Pacific near California?
A lot of the intelligence newsletters and newspapers I've read talk about how the Russians have a naval base in Venezuela, and they regularly patrol our East Coast, and the Chinese sail across the Pacific and patrol our West Coast, and that they're regularly going up and down because our sonar nets have fundamentally been abandoned since the end of the Cold War. Our military, our naval forces are fundamentally spread out. Most of them are in the Middle East. A few of them are in the Philippines and Japan.
This sounds like we violate just about every principle of Sun Tzu, including the fact that you want to have a defensible position that's unassailable.
Absolutely. Well, we rely on the fact that we are a large landmass. No one will ever invade us. But the problem is, what people forget is that the world's gotten smaller. With military technologies as it stands today, having the oceans doesn't protect us anymore. In a news article dated the 31st of January, the North Koreans said, we are putting our entire army on high alert. We're preparing them for war. We're going to do another nuclear test. Our missile test, what was in fact a missile test. We weren't putting up a satellite. It was a missile test. And the North Koreans were successful because the Chinese gave them the technology. At the same time, you see Iran and Syria saying that they're going to retaliate, saying that they'll retaliate against Israel. And so what you're starting to see now is the Chinese and the Russians are starting to move their proxies forward. The Chinese know that opportunity comes once every 10,000 years, and it's here. The United States is unbelievably overstretched. They have a bad economy, a population that does not have the stomach for a major war. And if you were to strike, without ever actually hitting the continental U.S., if you were to strike South Korea, Israel, and the Persian Gulf all at once, you would not only humiliate the American military, but you would greatly demoralize the American
people. And of
course,
people. You know, we've been talking about the Mideast, and we briefly mentioned the first Gulf War. It's really about China, Russia, and the United States. It's about oil. China, of course, has no oil, so it's dependent on imports. And that's why it's looking to places like Africa in particular.
Which is why the U.S. involvement in places like Mali is only provoking the Chinese.
And of course, Libya had become an important source of oil for the Chinese. They had thousands of workers there, which is an important reason why we attacked Libya to remove Gaddafi. He'd become friendly with the Chinese, longstanding ally of the Russians, breaking free of the United States control. So removing him had become an urgent matter. And I think it's important to note that controlling the oil is very important. Controlling the oil routes are very important, but denying access to oil, denying your rivals access to oil, is just as important as having it yourself.
Putin said the same thing. Putin said in his own manifesto that he who controls the world's access to natural resources controls the world. And anybody who thinks the Europeans will jump into our defense is nuts, because all of the oil and natural gas going to Europe come from Russia and the Ukraine. And so if Russia decides, and the Ukraine is a satellite state of Russia nowadays, they have a pro-Russian government. If we are to go to war and NATO says we're going to jump in and support the U.S., Russia just goes, no, you don't, click, and everything goes dark across Europe.
Clearly, the Chinese have a strong foreign policy interest in getting access to oil to fuel their growing industry. Do they have a special interest in the Pacific and in Asia?
Absolutely. Well, what the Russians and the Chinese have done is they've divvied up the world. The Russians said, okay, we get the Middle East, we get the whole Middle East and Western Europe. You can have parts of Africa and the whole of the Pacific. And the Chinese said, fine, we want
and there,
we get that.
There is a lot of oil in the China Sea.
Exactly. Which is why they've threatened to go to war with Japan over this series of islands. And this is all unraveled in a very short period of time.
Top priority for them is to push U.S. influence out of the Pacific.
It's more than that, because for the Russians, it's to push the U.S. out of the Middle East. The Chinese don't do that. The Chinese don't want to see a fall of the U.S. They don't want to see us just crippled. They want to see us destroyed. So if anybody were to hit us at home, it would be because the Chinese want – it would be Chinese-initiated. Their way of war is completely different than ours.
Then you go back to Sun Tzu. You wait and wait and wait until the time is right, but then you attack quickly.
Exactly, and viciously. What the American people have to understand, what I hope our listeners understand, is that you can only pull a tiger's tail for so long before he's going to bite you. And you can only poke a bear so long before he's going to maul you. And we're doing both. If you have a bear and a tiger next to each other, we're whacking one with a baseball bat and we're yanking on the tail of the other. Eventually, they'll eat us.
Well, thank you very much for this interesting conversation, Marshawn.
My pleasure. Thank you for doing the show.
You've been listening to In Context War Report. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I've been speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe about the Chinese tradition of warfare and China's military capabilities today as a rival to the United States in the global arena. In Context is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., and is broadcast on non-commercial, listener-sponsored WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streams at WPKN.org. We thank you listeners very much for your generous contributions to WPKN, which keep this community station independent and strong. In Context programs are archived for free listening at incontextreport.com and at WPKN.org. Thanks for joining us on In Context. See you next time.